Hello and welcome to the Talking Information Center. I'm Ron Clark, reading the Brockton Enterprise on Tuesday, February 17th. First article, Dispatcher Saves Four-Year-Old Who'd Stopped Breathing, by Amelia Stern. A four-year-old girl who suddenly stopped breathing at her family's East Bridgewater home Monday night is alive today thanks to a local 911 dispatcher, East Bridgewater police and fire officials said in a statement on Tuesday. On Monday, February 9th, just after 5:30 p.m., the family of a four-year-old girl who had stopped breathing dialed 911 for help, according to the statement. On the other end of the line, Sophia Zervos, a dispatcher for the Holbrook Regional Emergency Communications Center, answered the family's desperate call. Zervos calmly instructed the frantic family to begin chest compressions on their child as first responders rushed to their home. "We're going to do CPR, okay?" Zervos said on the recorded call. "We're going to start now. I'm going to count with you." For the next 2 minutes, Zervos counted each chest compression as the family worked to save their child, instructing them to begin again when, after the first round, their daughter still wasn't breathing. "You're doing a great job," Zervos said. "Everyone's already on the way." After another round of compressions, the child threw up and started to breathe again, letting out a healthy cry. The sound of the child coughing in the background was a powerful reminder of the impact of skilled, composed emergency call handling, HRECCQA/Q1 analyst Jenna M. DeGrace said. Even though East Bridgewater police and fire crews responded to the family's home in 4 minutes, by the time they arrived, the four-year-old was already alert and breathing. She was transferred to the hospital, where the family later reported she was doing well. "When we arrived, the child needed medical attention, but she was breathing on her own. Dispatcher Zervos helped these parents save their child's life," East Bridgewater Fire Chief John DiZalo said. Police Chief Michael Jenkins also commended Zervos for being there for the family in their time of crisis. "I'm sure they will never forget this call and the calm, measuring voice at the other end," Jenkins said. "I know I'll never forget it." End of article. Next article. In Brockton Schools, Official Warns About Dangerous Drop-Off Conditions, by Jacob Posner. Brockton School Committee member Stephen Pena sounded the alarm about dangerous conditions during drop-off and pick-up at schools in the district during the board's February 10th meeting. "You need to go to these schools and sit there and watch what's going on," he said. "I don't know how somebody hasn't been killed. A teacher hasn't been hit. A principal hasn't been hit. Fights haven't started. I'm just flabbergasted every time I go." Mayor Moises Rodriguez, who chairs the committee, agreed this was an urgent matter and suggested they hold a special meeting to address the problem the week of February 16th. "The committee should bring in people like the police chief and head of the Department of Public Works," he said, "so officials can put their heads together and figure out exactly how we can do this, because that's what we're supposed to do." Getting to and from school is dangerous. Pena had brought up safety during pickup and drop-off at the previous meeting of the committee. It was referred to a subcommittee, but that subcommittee has yet to meet. Excuse me. "The snow has magnified the issue," he said, explaining why he brought it up again. When Pena picks up his daughter from George Elementary School, he said he sees cars parked and double parked illegally in the street, sometimes four wide, and kids running across the street. "I'm really concerned that a first grader or a second grader is going to run across the street and get hit," he said. "I think this is something that raises to a level of a major concern." He said he's seen the same problems at the Davis K-8, Raymond Elementary, and Hancock Elementary schools. School committee member Anya Oliver asked that sidewalks leading to the schools be prioritized when the next snowstorm strikes. "It was unacceptable, and I feel the pain of the parents," she said. "We got calls, we got emails and texts, and were brutally attacked on social media and everywhere else." She said she saw students walking to school down the middle of Belmont Street. "We just don't want tragedy to happen, and then we'll do something," she said. "We need to be more proactive than reactive." Some kids have to stand in the middle of the road waiting for the bus because snow is blocking the bus stop, school committee member Joyce Asak said. Rodriguez said part of the problem is that businesses haven't pulled their weight clearing the snow. The city can't clear its 360 miles of roads by itself, he said, and businesses and residents are required to remove snow from sidewalks. We have had a ton of businesses in this community clearing their parking lot and piling snow on sidewalks, he said, explaining that the city can't remove it from the sidewalks because plows would have to push it into the streets, which would only worsen the condition. I can give you an example of banks that are not doing their sidewalks, he said. I can give you an example of the post office in the downtown area that refuses to clear the sidewalk. He said he will go to the city council to amend the snow removal ordinance with the goal of holding businesses and residents accountable. The city of Boston fines anyone who fails to clear snow, he said, adding, we don't want to go to that level with some of our residents, but it's getting to a point where the safety of kids has to be paramount. The current ordinance says violators can be fined $50. End of article. Next article. Massachusetts lost 33,000 residents last year by Margie Cullen. More people moved out of Massachusetts last year than moved to the state, census data released January 27th found. The data showed that Massachusetts experienced a net loss of 33,340 people to other states between July 1st and 2024 and July 1st, 2025. That's more than the previous year when Massachusetts lost about 19,000 people. The group that most leaves the state is those between 25 and 34, according to data presented by Sarah Strait, senior manager at the UMass Donahue Institute Population Estimates Program, at a Senate committee on the census hearing February 10th. But, in fact, most age groups, except those 18 to 24, which would include most college students, leave the state more than they come in. Why are people in Massachusetts moving to or where? These are the top states Massachusetts residents moved to in 2024 based on the UMass Donahue Institute presentation. First is Florida, then New Hampshire, then New York, then California, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Texas, Maine, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina. And where are people moving to Massachusetts coming from? Massachusetts is home to many colleges and universities, and the data shows that 18 to 24-year-olds are the group that most moves into the state. They come from New York, Rhode Island, California, New Hampshire, Florida, Connecticut, Maine, New Jersey, Texas, and Pennsylvania. Massachusetts is home to many colleges and universities. End of article. Next article, True North Bank debuts after merger of North Shore and Abington Banks by Beth McDermott. And this is an AI-assisted report. North Shore Bank, along with its Abington Bank division, announced that they have rebranded as True North Bank, effective February 9th. The new name reflects the combined bank's continued growth, expanding service area, more robust product and service offering, and unwavering dedication to the neighborhoods it proudly calls home. While the name is changing, True North Bank remains a trusted community bank, with the same people, same values, and same commitment to customers and communities. The True North Bank name honors the bank's strong local roots while signaling a clear direction forward. Grounded in decades of local service, those roots continue to fuel significant growth on the North Shore and South Shore of Massachusetts and in southern New Hampshire. As part of this rebrand, North Shore Bank and its Abington Bank division unite under one shared identity. True North Bank represents who we are today and where we're headed, said Michael R. Wheeler, True North Bank president and CEO. We are deeply rooted in the communities we serve, and those roots give us the strength to grow, evolve, and aim higher, without ever losing sight of what matters most, our customers, our neighbors, our people. The new name underscores True North Bank's renewed commitment to being a steady guide for individuals, families, and businesses, helping them navigate change, unlock potential, and move confidently toward their goals. Customers can expect the same personalized service, familiar faces, and trusted expertise they have always relied on. Community remains at the heart of True North Bank's mission. Through the Giving Tree, the bank's charitable giving and volunteer initiative, True North Bank will continue to support local nonprofits and causes that strengthen the communities it serves. Our name may be new, but our purpose is unchanged, added Wheeler. We remain committed to showing up, giving back, and supporting the places we live and work. True North Bank, headquartered in Peabody, has served the community for more than 135 years. It has more than $3.3 billion in assets and offers a complete line of consumer and business deposit and lending products and services through 29 branches located throughout the North and South Shore regions of Massachusetts and Southern New Hampshire. The bank is proud to fulfill its community banking mission, providing individualized financial support, a suite of comprehensive products and services, and smart banking technology, all to ensure our customers can unlock their potential and build a successful future. Through its sponsorship and charitable giving program, the Giving Tree, True North Bank, supports nonprofit organizations and causes throughout the communities it serves. In 2025, the Giving Tree donated more than $940,000 and over the last decade has donated nearly $5.3 million. The bank was named a Corporate Citizenship Award winner by Boston Business Journal, reaffirming its status as one of Massachusetts' most charitable companies. For more information, you can visit truebanknorth.com. True Bank North is a member of the Hometown Financial Group, a $6.9 billion multi-bank mutual holding company headquartered in East Hampton, Massachusetts, and the parent company of Bank ESB, Bank Hometown, True North Bank, and Hometown Mortgage. Hometown Financial and our banks are proud to be recognized nationally as a three-time USA Today Top Workplaces Award winner, and America's Best In-State Bank by Forbes, and a Top Place to Work by the Boston Globe and Hartford Current. End of article. Next article, an obituary, loving, elegant, and kind. The South Shore ice skating legend who skated until 90 dies at 97. On a cold but sunny Sunday, as thousands prepared for Super Bowl 60 and followed the televised Olympic Winter Games, 18 veteran ice dancers gathered at La Scala Ristorante in Randolph for a silver celebration of their own. They came to remember an elegant and kind woman with powerful lung capacity who had inspired and helped others on the ice for more than 60 years. Polly Jordan, the Weymouth ice dancer they were honoring, began skating as a teenager on Great Pond in Weymouth and continued even after breaking her hip at age 84 until she was 90. Polly died in early January at age 97. She had continued to join the ice dancers' social gatherings until last year. "We are like family," Joe Reese of Peabody, who organized the luncheon, said. "We all adored Polly for so many years. She was a good friend to so many, and nothing kept her down." Getting together was a chance to share old photos and stories. It was also a happy reminder of how activities that people pursue in their younger days can become lasting social connections and shared joy. Colin Sullivan, a professional figure skater who performed with Dorothy Hamill and Peggy Fleming, was there. Sullivan taught Polly Jordan and others at the Pilgrim Skating Arena in Hingham and at other rinks in Greater Boston for 25 years. "You are all a community to one another," he told the skaters on Sunday, February 8th. "Loving, elegant, and kind is how skater and former ballroom dancer Lenny Colarusso described the Polly that he knew. Every year, he would invite the skaters for a day at his summer house on a pond in Carver. And he recalled always receiving handwritten thank you notes from her, even for such simple acts as making a phone call. Now working as a luxury property specialist with William Ravis Real Estate in Boston, Sullivan described how Polly, 40 years older, started as a student and became a friend, even joining him and his parents once during their family vacation at Little Sebago Lake in Maine. I saw a relaxed side of Polly, he said. Among the adult skaters that Sullivan worked with, he said, Polly was at the top of her field. In addition to ice dancing skills, she showed enviable endurance. She had incredible reserves in her lung capacity. After we'd been around the rink a number of times, I'd be huffing and puffing, and she'd say, "Can we try that again?" What also made Polly so special was the joy she found and communicated while skating. Many of her skating companions described her as always beaming as she circled the rink. Absent was the look of fear or apprehension about falling that older skaters tend to have. Her positive attitude towards life, her joy and confidence, translated so well onto the ice, Sullivan said. Missing from the luncheon was a good friend of Polly's, fellow skater Joan Smith, a nurse who accompanied Polly to the hospital when Polly fell on the ice in Lexington and broke her hip at age 84. Joan died just over a year ago, in December 2024, at 93. The two skated into their late 80s together. Polly was both an inspiring and encouraging presence on the ice for younger skaters. Louis Chukin began skating in Brockton in his 20s after he emigrated from Peru and eventually met Polly at the ACF Arena. 20 years older, she befriended both him and his wife, Janet, also a skater, who had also grown up in Weymouth and knew Polly's family. Now 77, Chukin lives in Bridgewater and continues to skate. And Kim Bozan, 56, of Halifax, was just 7 when Polly showed her how to figure skate. Bozan was the niece of Polly's skating partner, Arnold Turner, and she would go with the couple to skate at Winter Gardens in Cohasset. Polly showed her the dance steps, gave her tips on balance, and eventually Bozan became an ice dancer as well. Polly had grown up in Weymouth with Turner, skating on the ponds, and they made a handsome couple as ice dancing partners. They were engaged for 30 years, according to Turner's niece, and then had a complicated breakup. Both continued to speak fondly of one another. Polly graduated from Weymouth High School in 1947, then worked as a secretary supervisor at the Boston Safe Deposit and Trust Company in Boston, where Ralph Lowell, founder of GBH Radio and Television, was president. She would drive into work with her father or take the train from Weymouth. She always lived in the house where she'd grown up, and she took care of her mother for many years. After her mother died, she told skating friends that she missed her but loved her new freedom. She did yard work herself, trimmed tree branches, painted, and even tried small roof repairs. She was an unusual woman, Joe Reese, who visited Polly at her home with his wife, said. In 2009, when I first met the older skaters in Hingham, I expected to see people moving slowly and sedately in circles. I arrived and saw skaters coming quite rapidly towards me on the ice, executing turns, fancy steps, and deft stops. They even skated backwards with confidence, and everyone looked happy. Sullivan skated up with the late Gene Alberti, 79, pleased to be with some of his favorite students because of their love of the sport. At the time, Polly was 81, and I asked her if she wasn't afraid of falling and breaking something. "Not at all," she assured me. "We do what our teachers tell us, keep our core straight and strong, and just don't worry about it. We could get hurt at home." I visited Polly at her home in 2017 when she was 88, 4 years after she had broken her hip and recovered, and she was still skating. "I just go easy," she said. "I can't skate out hard like I used to, but the doctor and surgeon at Leahy Clinic said, go ahead and skate. And they did a wonderful job with the hip repair. It's good and it is strong. It's good exercise and good to get out and be with people, and I enjoy seeing the little kids on the ice." When I first met and wrote about Polly, I described a sweet, petite woman with a warm heart and a very strong will. She loves ice dancing and skating with a passion and will not be deterred. That did not change over more than a decade. And that is how many friends remember her today, in absentia. End of article. Next article. Brockton Rocks catcher signs with the Houston Astros. For one Brockton Rocks player, the big leagues are calling. By the way, this article is written by Jansen McNair. Brockton Rocks catcher Emmanuel Rosario has signed with the Houston Astros, landing a deal with Major League Baseball club. Join us in congratulating Rosario and wishing him the best as he takes the next step up, the Rocks said in a Facebook post. We're rooting for you always. The 25-year-old catcher was signed to a minor league contract with the Astros and assigned to the FCL Astros on February 2nd, according to the Major League Baseball's website. Jared Edmondson, manager for the Brockton Rocks, said Rosario will be greatly missed at the organization. I couldn't be happier for Rosie to have this opportunity to sign with the Houston Astros. After back-to-back great years in the Frontier League, he has certainly earned a chance to advance to the next level, he said in a prepared statement. He's been such a huge piece of the Brockton Rocks organization, and we will miss having his presence in our lineup and his leadership in our clubhouse every day. A message was left for the Houston Astros requesting a comment on the signing. A few questions. When does the Brockton Rocks season start? The Brockton Rocks' first game of the season is scheduled for Thursday, May 7th at the New York Boulders. When is the Brockton Rocks' home opener? The Brockton Rocks' first home game is scheduled for Friday, May 15th against the Ottawa Titans. End of article. Next article from out of town. Guards failed to stop killing in prison. Inmate cellmate slowly choked him to death. By Nolan Clay of The Oklahoman. Dustin James Patterson didn't have to die. Correctional officer Connor Whitlock was doing the 2 a.m. inmate count in a maximum security unit at what was then known as the Davis Correctional Facility in Holdenville, Oklahoma. Looking inside cell Echo Charlie 103, the officer saw Patterson in the dark struggling for his life. His cellmate, Darren Padrone, had him in a chokehold. It was 2:14 a.m. The officer reached for his pepper spray and blasted into the cell. Then he radioed for help, according to an investigative report on the incident. What happened next on that early morning of September 2nd, 2022, is documented in two prison videos that show Patterson's long, agonizing death as guards stood outside the cell's door. He had his arm wrapped around his neck from the back, Whitlock would later say in testimony about that night. Patterson was asking his cellmate over and over to stop, the officer said. He was clawing at Mr. Padrone's arm and head, trying to get his arm off of him. The at times shaky videos show more and more officers arriving at cell 103. For 45 minutes, they took steps to try to stop the struggle, but only from outside the steel cell door. When they did enter the cell, it was too late. A review by the Oklahoman of 21 homicides at the medium security prison in the past 4 years found Patterson's death was by far the most preventable. The officers didn't go in because they couldn't get the inmates handcuffed first, the videos show. It was totally avoidable, and I think we've got a duty to protect these guys on a base level at least, said Hughes County District Attorney Eric Johnson, who charged Padrone with first-degree murder. Johnson, a Republican in his first term as district attorney, was so disturbed by what he saw in the videos that he provided them to the Oklahoman, part of the USA Today network. They could have opened the door and stopped the attack at any time, and they didn't, he said. Over and over, officers directed the two inmates to submit to hand restraints, the videos show. Stop and cuff up, officers said, at times shouting. That command requires one inmate to stick his hands behind him, through a food slot in the cell door to be handcuffed. The second inmate must sit on a bunk or stand against the wall. The first inmate then sits down or stands against the wall while the second is handcuffed the same way. More than once, Patterson tried to comply by putting both hands in front of him through the slot, the videos show. Where's my cuffs at? Whitlock said the first time, turning away from the cell door. Getting handcuffs, he turned back to Patterson. Turn around, he commanded. I can't, Patterson said. We don't front cuff anybody, Whitlock explained at Padrone's preliminary hearing in 2023. At the time, I didn't want to take his hands away from him because Mr. Padrone was not stopping. Officers filled the cell with alloration capsicum spray, a painful non-lethal deterrent made from chili peppers, the videos show. It's pretty much a can of mace, Whitlock said at the preliminary hearing. The officers went through canister after canister of the spray, deploying 126 ounces in all. investigator Seth Day later wrote in the report on the incident. On the videos, cries of pain can be heard from inside the cell as the spray hits. Padron didn't stop. The videos show officers also twice fired pepper balls at Padron through the door slot. He'd be hit at least 10 times, developing 9 welts on his back and lower left flank, and 1 bloody welt on his cheek. Day noted in his report, in all, the officers deployed 30 pepper balls into the cell. Again, Padron didn't stop. Officers could hear Patterson begging for his life, according to the affidavit. Finally, the officers saw Padron straddle Patterson on the floor, put his hands around Patterson's neck, and strangle Patterson until the inmate became unresponsive. In the beam of a flashlight, Captain Stephen Eller saw Patterson was no longer moving. The second video shows the captain had had enough. He said, "Bring those shields." Still, they didn't go in immediately. They had to wait 3 more minutes for somebody to bring the cell door key. While they waited, officers deployed more pepper spray and continued to shout, "Cuff up." At 3 a.m., they opened the door and went in, 45 minutes after Whitlock first discovered the struggle between the two inmates. Whitlock was the third officer to enter the cell. Padron was washing his face at the sink, he told the investigator. Padron was escorted out without resistance. The second video shows he complained his wrist restraints were too tight and demanded that officers quit treating me like a bad guy, according to Day's report. Patterson was still on his back on the cell floor. He wasn't moving. An officer in his gas mask pressed the neck and said, "I can't find a pulse." The officer then attempted CPR to revive him. The second video shows a medical worker brought in automated external defibrillator. It wouldn't shock. CPR was tried again. Padron had just 2 weeks left in his prison sentence for robbery, escape, and other crimes. Prosecutors at one point sought the death penalty over the strangulation, but then dropped their request. Under a deal, Padron pleaded guilty in 2024 to a reduced charge, second-degree manslaughter. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Padron, now 36, is being held at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary. End of article. Thank you for joining us today at the Talking Information Center, and please enjoy a wonderful day.